broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, happy to have you along. We are talking about RedPillExpo.com. Incredible event last weekend, 2 days of some of the most amazing speakers you've ever heard and seen on Jekyll Island, Georgia. If you missed the event, there's still hope because you can go online to RedPillExpo.com. $35 gets you 60 days of all the presentations. You can check that out, ladies and gentlemen. Incredible. You won't miss anything. You can check it out in the comfort of your own home. Our next guest, Elaine Willman, with us. Welcome to Liberty Roundtable Live.
Thank you, Sam. It's really a joy to be here, and I'm just soaking up the camaraderie and the information. The content information at this event is completely mind-boggling.
It awesome. Is mind-boggling, yes. To say the least. Now, you got an interesting term after your name. It's MPA. What's that?
That's MPA is Masters in Public Administration.
Woo.
Yeah. I also have 96 credits towards a doctoral, a PhD in Federal Indian Policy. However, I did not do the dissertation. So I say that I have the ABD. I have the all but the dissertation.
There you go. Are you going to do your dissertation and finish?
I don't think so now. This was years ago, and I had the choice of accepting a marvelous job near Green Bay, Wisconsin, to work on Indian policy with that community, or finish my dissertation. And so I put my studies on hold and took the work, and so I'm fine with my education now.
All right. But you did write a book called American Tribal Tyranny, right?
Yes, and it's my third book, and it's just out. And it's amazingly, it's selling extremely well on all the websites, Amazon.com and whatnot. And I've had an awesome number of bulk orders, and I've not even started the marketing, really, but I've had orders for 100 books or 50 books, 500 books. For some reason, this is hitting a chord, because I've written two other books that also sold pretty well, but this one is jumping out, and it's only been out less than 2 months.
Elaine, what are the other two books, real quick?
Well, do you remember the old movie of Thelma and Louise? Myself and a videographer, a gal, took a road trip across from Washington State to New York State, across 17 Indian reservations, and we interviewed the tribal families and the farmers and cattlemen and sheriffs and teachers, all that live on those reservations, and videoed all of them. And we were going to do a documentary, but their stories were so strong, we promised everyone we'd get them in, and we couldn't get them all in a documentary. So I went back home and relived that trip in writing. I just took everything off the videos, and it's our travels, and it tells the story. It's a great story about these two women that took this trip across Indian reservations, but as you read that, you get accidentally educated on the realities of what these government decisions are doing to our country.
And you could say accidentally, or you can say purposefully, right?
Well, yeah, it was an intended consequence, but I needed to write it in a local, easy-to-read form. Because most folks are completely, if you don't live on a reservation or near one, you have no clue what this is happening, what this is costing the country.
Yeah, believe it or not, I actually know quite a bit about it, so let's dig right in. First of all, people need to understand a couple of things here. The book is called American Tribal Tyranny for a reason. We'll get to that in just a second. But what I want to say is people don't understand two things. One, the current plight of the Indians or the Native Americans, whatever term you want to use. And two, they don't understand the historical reality of how we got where we are today, right?
Right. But I'd like to start with a disclaimer, Sam, if I can, because I have lived on three separate reservations for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Most of my friends are tribal members, and I've worked and helped tribal members. I am Cherokee. And my husband is a direct descendant of Sacagawea.
Okay.
So I always make clear distinctions between my love and affection of American Indian history and ancestry and culture and traditions. That's all part of my family, too. But that is very different than the government decisions that I've been researching for 30 years and that are destroying the enrolled tribal members. They're still suffering with all the wealthy governments, 574 tribal governments, all enormously wealthy. There's no excuse for ongoing decades of poverty for the members on the reservation.
All right, so let's dig in and talk about this tyranny here. How federal Indian policy secretly, that's kind of the key, right?
Yes, very much so. One of the reasons it's secret is because it is decisions made by Congress or federal agencies and administrators and tribal government leaders, and there's no requirement for public information or public discussion or public hearings, nor are the tribal members informed of what their leaders are up to with the federal agencies and often state agencies as well.
So are the Indian Affairs leaders, even on the tribe side, betraying their constituents, if you will?
Well, they have a different governing system. You know, in our system, legislation includes public disclosure.
Yeah, in other words, we have a separation of powers and to some degree transparency, right?
And tribal governments operate under a constitutional charter, and they have a tribal constitution that looks strikingly similar to ours. The difference is they don't follow their constitution. And so, and every American Indian is an American citizen. Every enrolled Indian is a full-on American citizen. They've all been Indian citizens since 1924. But as they enroll in a tribal government, they lose that Bill of Rights. They lose many of their freedoms that they would ordinarily enjoy as a full-on citizen.
They think what they're being is loyal to their tribe. What they don't realize is they're getting shafted on both ends.
Exactly. And then there's some very strong emotional, psychological pressure that goes on those that are still on the reservations. 4 out of 5 have left. But the ones that are still there don't know much different. And they are told, if you leave the reservation, if you disenroll, you're not an Indian. But that's kind of goofy. But they're told those kinds of things.
You are as your heritage denotes, regardless of their dishonest manipulations.
Exactly. So, there was a reason I wrote this third book, because we need the whole American government to understand we're really all American citizens. My long-term goal is that we stop this nonsense of hyphenated Americans.
Okay, so if we jettison African-Americans, Native Americans,
Hispanic,
let me tell you a little story that kind of relates to this. I went to Alaska, and we were on a bus, and this guy was talking about Native Americans and the Indians, and I raised my hand, and I said, I'm a Native American, because I've been here for generations. My family came years and years ago. So, hey, if I'm here 3 or 4 generations later, I'm as Native, right?
Yeah.
But he said, no, you're not a Native American. You're an American Native. And I thought that was an interesting word game.
Yeah.
And what that really does is separate us all to where, well, I don't understand them.
Yeah.
They don't understand me. It couldn't be further from the truth, right?
Right. And there's a lot of, when you mentioned word games, Sam, there's a lot of words that have been kind of hijacked. You know, one of them is indigenous.
Yes.
Every person born in the United States is indigenous.
Yeah, we all get born naked, don't we?
Yeah, I know.
We start out with nothing, and we...
indigenous. But what happened to me that caused me to put this third book out, and it's my most simple read, but it's also a blunt and somewhat snarky read. I was kind of worried about the reaction. But it is
because you're making a point, though, and you're trying to get people to wake up and jolt into an understanding, though.
Yes.
It's not a snarky read to be snarky. It's a snarky read to say, folks, you've got to be jolted into a wake-up state on this thing, right?
And here's what was a last straw for me, Sam.
Yes.
I was, I'm sort of a Fox News addict. and I was,
we'll get you to graduate to Liberty Roundtable. It's all right.
There you go. And but there was a CNN clip on Fox News that caught my attention, and there was this large, full-screen picture of this fellow, this chairman of the Navajo tribe a couple of years ago, and he's shoulder shot full-screen on CNN. Well, I'm quite aware that CNN is in all the airports in all the world. And this gentleman, this chief of the Navajo Nation, is on CNN, and he said, I'm paraphrasing, but it's nearly verbatim, he said, all of America is Indian country. All of the soils, the rivers, the plants are Indian country, and every non-Indian is a guest and should act like it. Now, that man said that man said that on CNN. It's in the front of my book because it caused me to write this book. And I thought, that's it. Here is that we are a government that has totally funded only Native Americans, one ethnicity. We fund their basic needs times 574 tribes. The American taxpayer doesn't even know they're doing this, and it's multi-billions every year. We fund all the basic needs of these tribal governments.
But we also hold them down when we fund their basic needs too, right?
No, we don't, because we've given them one thing after another. Congress has given them an exclusive monopoly on gaming in 1988. In 2014, Obama gave them the Indian Energy Policy Act, for heaven's sakes. The Indian Energy Policy Act, throwing billions out to these tribes to take over management and operation of dams and rivers and our public power. Now, tribal governments have no duty to that customer base. Their only duty is to their enrolled members. But this is what I mean. Congress has, throughout the years, provided them one benefit and resource after another, in addition to the basic services that we all pay for.
But you know what it reminds me of, though? It reminds me a lot of a union. The leaders get empowered and get rich, and the rank and file get the shaft, though.
Exactly.
So that's what I mean by it's held them down.
It has held the members down that live on the reservation, that's
right.
For sure.
That's right, and that's what I mean. Certainly the tribe and the leadership are very rich and wealthy, and the con game continues.
Yeah.
And what it really amounts to is a divide-and-conquer tactic against we the people.
Very much so. Very much so. And then they've taken the liberty of the leaders and lobbyists. They pay for multi-lobbyists that are in the Congress all the time. They were now given the Indian Child Welfare Act, and that act, Congress gave full parental rights to the tribal government. So enrolled tribal members have no parental rights. Those parental rights belong to the government for every enrollable child 18 and under. The problem with that, and the reason for that, was that many of the American Indians are leaving the reservation. They really are setting goals and fulfilling their life, and they're assimilating. I mean, most of them are fully assimilated now. So the numbers of the population on these reservations is dwindling, and Congress's answer to that was to allow a tribal government to go anywhere across the country, and if they find an enrollable child, they can take that child from the parent and take them back to the reservation.
And by the way, this is being used as a model eventually for that to happen to all of us, whether it be COVID, whether it be government education, the fact that they say you're not educating your child properly. Yeah. It's a prototype for a future vision that they have for all of us.
See, and you're getting to the tyranny part, aren't you?
Yes, I am, because I understand it.
Yeah.
Now, the other interesting thing about this that most people don't realize is this is all happening behind the scenes. It's all happening, as you mentioned, in your book, By Secret.
Yes.
Okay, this is the important part to understand. Yeah. This model is being tried out on the Native Americans, or whatever you want to call them, Indians, whatever. But it's really being refined as a model, eventually to roll out to the whole nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's remarkable, because one of my favorite complaints is the U.S. Census Bureau. When we do the census every year, and I think the Census Bureau has a total of like 156 ethnic boxes you can mark. Now, we're one nation under God.
Amen.
We're all Americans, period. I really resent and confront hyphenated Americans. But the Census Bureau promotes it, and each one of those little ethnicity boxes goes to some funding for a specific ethnicity.
Yes.
So, but primarily it's going to Indians. But we also have a new trend that's happening, and California is your prime example right now, and that is the state legislature of California has passed legislation signed by Governor Newsom to start paying black Americans in California reparations for black slavery.
And that's kind of going to be modeled after the Indian experiment found divides and conquers right?
Yeah, and so then we're going to start ramping up and funding by ethnicity our federal and state funds on the backs of the remaining taxpayers in this country.
And they will use education as the big wedge, won't they?
Yeah, and here's the overarching problem. These are what I call big, giant yesterday sticks. These are things that took place in our country for all of its wonder and warts. These are things that took place yesterday that the people living today and funding all this have nothing to do with. They're not responsible for this. But, you know, slavery and the Indian issues are very big yesterday thing. And all they have to do is keep screaming at it. You can't argue with yesterday.
Yeah,
we can't change yesterday. But they keep doing the guilt trip on everybody, and the taxes and money keeps going out by ethnicity instead of us being Americans.
Elaine Willman, ladies and gentlemen, with me. American Tribal Tyranny is the title of her book, available on Amazon and literally everywhere. Just search for it by name, American Tribal Tyranny. It talks about how secret money is being used to drive a wedge between all the peoples of America, whether it be the Indians or Native Americans or whatever term you prefer, whether it be the blacks. Eventually, they will use this money wedge to drive between us all, and we will all pay dearly for past mistakes with no end in sight is the wedge they're driving. Don't let them do it is the point. So, Elaine, what do you think the solution is? Is it to get rid of reservations? Is it to get rid of the funding for different groups?
I've got some solutions suggested in the end of my book, and one of them involves the Census Bureau. Here would be my dream for America. This makes all kinds of sense to me. My dream is that we no longer allow any federal or state dollars to go out that are focused on one ethnicity. That what we do...
Yeah, in other words, what's good for one is good for all. Let's treat us like that, right?
Right. So what we do is we look at your American citizenship, and if there are four Americans in a household, and that household is below an established poverty threshold, that household gets benefits. That we base our services and need legitimate needs on American citizenship only, and base it on the household. And that way, you can get rid of all of this hyphenated American stuff. And people of every ethnicity, as an American citizen in a poverty household, is assisted. That's equality for all.
You could do that for a temporary time until they can get on their feet, too. It wouldn't be
a hand out.
Would be a hand up
in
a transitionary reality.
And you know what that would
because
do?
Because you bring up the Puerto Rican question, you bring up all kinds of other discussions with this same topic, right?
Yeah, and you know what that would do for downsizing the federal government? We'd be done with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and we'd be done with many of the agencies who are just bulk overly staffed, like 4,000 employees in the Census Bureau, overly staffed, just focusing on one ethnicity.
You would also separate that leadership of many of these reservation tribe leaderships, too, that stand in the middle, who have handsome gains upon the manipulation here. And I'm not trying to attack different people, but I'm trying to say that leadership isn't really fair and open and honest with the rank and file either.
No. If I can take one more minute.
Sure.
I've been researching and looking for years for the root origin of how did this happen. And I found it in 1830. There were three judicial rulings. There was a feud between two men of great stature and great ego who hated each other. One was Chief Justice John Marshall of the Supreme Court. He was there for many years.
Huh?
Yeah, and the other was President Andrew Jackson. President Andrew Jackson was a populist, which is one of the reasons I think Trump speaks of him frequently. Jackson was a populist who believed in states' rights and American citizen individuality. And Chief Justice Marshall was biased towards a strong central government. So when the Cherokee Nation told the state of Georgia, we will govern our reservation here in Georgia, Georgia said, I don't think so. And President Andrew Jackson said, oh, hell no. You know, and so these three Supreme Court cases just came up quite quickly to Chief Justice John Marshall, and he ruled, finding not a word in the Constitution, he drew from international law, he legislated from the bench, and he ruled that the federal government had a trust relationship with its Indians, that they were dependent wards. He just legislated that.
And he should have been impeached over it.
Yeah, and Jackson said, good luck enforcing that, and went to Congress and started the Indian Removal Act. That was the root origin of federal Indian policy in 1830. And that grew because then Congress had to set up an agency to manage those trusts with the Indians. So we got the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and even the BIA could not manage individual Indians, so they started focusing only with tribal leaders, and it just grew from there. And it has exploded exponentially every year since. We're talking 150 years or more.
Elaine Devery Willman, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Her book, American Tribal Tyranny, available now. The reason I know quite a bit about this is I've dealt a lot with Puerto Rico, so I understand their unique, strange status. I also had an Indian girl come and live with my family and virtually become my sister. She was from San Carlos, Arizona when I was young. And she was from the Apache tribe. And I learned a lot about the reservations. And I'm also a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I don't know if you know, but the Mormons have had a relationship with the Indians forever.
Oh, for years.
And they've had a completely different relationship with the Indians than the government. We've treated them as fair, honest, open equals. And others have not. And so that's why I know quite a bit about it, actually.
Well, and the tribal families that I've lived around for 30 years are just awesome folks.
Of course.
If we got the government out of the way, I believe they could be free to advance themselves. But here's one of the nasty things.
And
then,
by the way, they could be free to not only be Americans, yeah, and be treated as one, yeah, no hyphenations involved,
right,
but they would also be free to hold on to their culture, which they're struggling,
yeah,
to do,
exactly,
as it currently stands. But they could be free to enhance that and be Americans simultaneously, right?
But here's my counter to the holding on to our culture part, because those ethnicities that want to honor their culture and their traditions over the centuries, they do so because it's the right thing to do.
Sure.
They don't have to be paid to do it.
That's right. And that's why I say, if we're all treated as all Americans, yeah, they'd be free to do it, not manipulated, yeah,
right,
to do it, right?
Right.
It wouldn't become a on-display culture for,
right,
tourism.
Right.
It would be a real ingrained culture passed from
legitimate
parent to child,
yeah,
in a legitimate way, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. It really would be. And if it got government out of the picture, the other thing is, in ending federal Indian policy, the land that belongs to the tribal government would be transitioned, or it's held in all their, they don't own land. The federal government owns their land. But the federal government would pass those titles, deeds back to the tribal governments to own themselves. And that land would go back into state jurisdiction, and their businesses would become state businesses, and the state would have they would be citizens like the rest of us in our states.
And then what we might end up doing is creating more states in the Union as a result.
No, I don't think so.
You don't think that would happen?
No, no. Number one, there should not have been in the first place separate governments in states. You know, when states are granted their statehood, they acquire all the lands and the waters and the natural resources of that state within their bounded area. And our Constitution says no state within a state. It also says no governments, separate governments in states. But the federal government has put down, I'll give Washington State as the poster child, 31 reservations and tribes in Washington State. You can put 3 Washington states in Montana, where I'm from. 31 tribes, and the power of those tribes, they completely control politically and financially Olympia, the state capital, and the governor's office, to the point where Washington State has passed legislation acknowledging tribal sovereignty as superior to their own state sovereignty.
Which is insanity.
Insanity. But the money talks. The other thing, the other game that's been played is these tribal governments are allowed to directly, and they use their free money from gaming because we pay all the other stuff. They use their gaming money to buy politicians. They can directly contribute to political parties or candidates or incumbents.
And yeah, they don't have all the restrictions,
yeah,
I understand.
Yeah.
So it's a special privilege for the few at the expense of the rest.
Yes.
It's unacceptable. It's
yes.
all greased the palms by secret
yes.
money. And
yes.
ladies and gentlemen, it's got to stop, because eventually it will be the demise of America as we divide and conquer over every fault line possible.
Yeah.
You got to understand it, ladies and gentlemen. Read America, yeah. Tribal Tyranny, because it'll help you get caught
yeah.
up on what's going on.
And that's why the title of my first book was Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. It's a sneaky, creeping incrementalism removing the republic form of government from other states.
Elaine, God bless you. Thank you so yeah. much for your work.
Thank you for your time and the wonderful event here.
You
I'm
bet.
Glad you guys are here.
Thank you so much. Okay. Liberty Roundtable Live, ladies and gentlemen.
If Planned Parenthood were what they publicly declare themselves to be, they would welcome transparency. We all know why they hide, because we know what they hide. We can confirm federal judges who follow the Constitution rather than reverse engineer their preferred policy outcomes. The truth about abortion is spreading because of advances in medical imaging, because of brave journalists, tireless activists, compassionate doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals. The rising generation of young Americans is the most pro-life in decades because they know too. And one day soon, we will reaffirm our nation's principles in their dignified fullness and avow once again that all men are created equal. All are entitled to life.
Scott Bradley here. Most Americans are painfully aware that the nation is on the wrong track and in dire straits. Unfortunately, most political pundits only nibble around the edges when they claim to address the issues. Even worse, many of the so-called solutions are simply rewarmed servings of what got us into the mess we currently face. And the politicians think we're so gullible and naive that we'll buy their lies that they have reformed and now understand where they led us astray. Unfortunately, the truth of the matter is that they simply wish to continue to hold power. The solution to America's challenges is found in returning to the timeless principles found in the United States Constitution. My book and lecture series will reawaken in Americans an understanding and love of the principles which made this nation the freest, most prosperous, happiest, and most respected nation on earth. Visit topreservethenation.com and order my book and lectures to begin the restoration of this great nation.
As a parent, is receiving a faith-based, character-focused education for your children difficult to find? Do you believe that godly principles should be a central component in your child's education? Imagine a school where faith and integrity are at its center, where heritage and responsibility instill character. For over 40 years, American Heritage School has been educating both hearts and minds, bringing out academic excellence. This is the school where character and embracing the providence of a living God are fundamental, where students' national test scores average near the 90th percentile. With American Heritage School's Advanced Distance Education Program, distance is no longer an issue. With an accredited LDS-oriented curriculum from kindergarten through 12th grade, your children can attend from anywhere in the world. American Heritage School will prepare your child for more than a job. It will prepare them for life. To learn more, visit American-Heritage.org. That's American-Heritage.org.
Begging politicians, bureaucrats, and educrats, and all do-gooders to please obey the supreme law of the land, the Constitution. This is Liberty Roundtable.
Happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman, Liberty Roundtable live. Wow, broadcasting live from Red Pill Expo on Jekyll Island. It has been an incredible event, ladies and gentlemen, from start to finish and beyond. If you missed it, have no fear. Mr. Ed Griffin has done an incredible job making the video presentations all available online. You can get a pass for $35, 60 days, watch all the presentations you missed. One of the best presentations that I think is so relevant for our time today, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, MD, the pandemic fraud runs much deeper than you think. AndrewKaufmanMD.com, welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, Sam. It's great to be with you.
Now, let's get a little bit about your background. Who are you first, doctor?
Sure. I think you said my name. I'm a medical doctor. I was trained principally in forensic psychiatry, where I'm board certified, but I had a lot of different experiences prior to that. I've started up a medical device company. I've been an expert witness. I've published original research. I've held leadership positions in academic medicine and had quite a bit of variety in my career, and I think it uniquely put me in a position to be able to look at some of the scientific evidence behind what's going on right now and have a different understanding based on a bit of a skeptical way of looking at the material.
Now, I think most people get psychiatry has to do with the brain, and psychiatry means you can practice medicine and provide medication and all that kind of stuff. Help people kind of get the forensic piece. That's kind of important to understand, right?
Yeah, sure. It's a unique specialty in medicine, really. There's not any other forensic subspecialties except for pathology where they're, you know, autopsying bodies. So what forensic psychiatry is, it's kind of the intersection of mental health and legal and administrative matters. So it could be working as an expert witness, let's say in a criminal case, like for the insanity defense. It could be related to a lawsuit where there are psychological damages, or I did a lot of work related to employment where people have a mental illness interfering with their ability to work. And then also it involves providing psychiatric care within criminal justice system, like at juvenile detention facilities, jails, and prisons, and I've had experience in all those settings.
So it's really kind of an analyzing and then an expert witness situation about what you see around you.
Yeah, that's actually 100% correct. So for any case that I was involved in, there would be varying degrees of records, sometimes even thousands of pages. And what you do is you comb through all of this data related to a person's situation and whatever the merits of the case are, and you're looking for clues that support your ability to answer a certain question. And it's very, very applicable to this current situation where you have to, say, look at bits of information and say, what do they add up to? What can you conclude from looking at these little pieces of information?
And let me tell you why I bring this up and set the stage like this, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, because you are not only qualified, but uniquely qualified to the point of even being cross-examined and have the ability to stand up and say, hey, my credibility is on the line here, but you know what? I can withstand the scrutiny because of the background I got. Or I have, I should say, because of the background that I have, because of the experiences that I've gone through, because of my expert witness situation, because of my ability to analyze situations and understand. Now we're talking about individuals, but to the many, right? But you're uniquely qualified, even to the point of being able to be cross-examined on these kind of topics, right?
Well, I think that's a very astute point you bring up, because when you have to present an opinion in a courtroom and you know that you're going to be very firmly cross-examined, you have to really think carefully about your opinion and say, what are the strengths and weaknesses of this? And, you know, even play devil's advocate and try to create questions that would fumble up your opinion and see if they hold up to scrutiny. And, you know, I actually do this in the process, not when it's time to prepare for a hearing, but I do this when I'm formulating my opinion, because I want to make sure, you know, do I really have enough evidence to support this opinion, or is it too weak and I can't really decide? Because if I don't have enough evidence to support a strong opinion, I need to tell whoever I'm working for that there's not enough evidence.
Yeah, this isn't sellable.
Right? Exactly. And so applying that to this situation was really useful to be able to just naturally think in that way. And I want to add one more thing that I think is counterintuitive to most people's opinion about my qualifications to make opinions about this. But, you know, I'm not a virologist. I'm not a scientist in the laboratory who studies viruses.
And that's what
right?
they'll try to use against you, right?
Absolutely. But I think actually it's an advantage not to be, because I have nothing invested in forwarding the current dogma of virology. I'm an outsider. I can look at it from a neutral perspective. I have nothing invested in it one way or the other. I just want to find out, is the science they're doing good science, and can I draw the conclusions from their experiments that they draw from it?
But you also have the added knowledge, too, where a virologist might have some of the, quote, under the microscope discussions, or whatever you want to say like that, scientific method discussions. They don't have any ability to speak to the psyche, to the reality, to the whatever you want to call it, in societal realities that you might be able to speak to.
Well, you know, I mean, I certainly can talk about psychological aspects, like, for example, how lockdown policies affected people. And I have some unique perspectives on that because of my expertise. But the thing is, you know, if you're a trained scientist, you should be able to read scientific articles in almost any field. I mean, there are some fields that are highly technical that you need some specialized knowledge, but in general, just understanding the scientific method and various principles of reasoning and mathematics, you know, you can almost look at any field, really, and get a sense of if they're doing good science or not, for sure.
That's only on one condition, sir, that you're honest.
Well, absolutely, I agree with that.
And I bring that up because it's an important point to make. Many people, based on their positions, aren't honest. Money might be the cause. Their credibility and the fear of their career destruction might be at stake. All those things. But many simply aren't willing to stand up, as you are, based on those concerns, right?
Well, you know, there are personal consequences for standing up and going against a mainstream narrative. For example, I was terminated from an employment contract because of my refusal to wear a mask, which I felt, in addition to not being an effective preventative measure, was a major barrier to do psychiatry. Imagine, you know, someone very vulnerable talking to me about their trauma and they can't even see my facial reactions. You know, how would they know if I'm laughing at them, or, you know, it's just not...
Or even
not
the caring or concern in your eyes.
Exactly. So I found that to be, you know, an untenable way to practice psychiatry, but nonetheless, I lost my main source of income as a result of that.
But I would say it's disingenuous for them to fire you over your true ability to read your patients and understand, though. What I mean is there's a disconnect there, sir.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, they are looking at things from a different perspective. And I think, you know, in general, when we have organizations and we have hospitals and medical groups, the main mission of those organizations and groups is to sustain themselves, to maintain their solvency and their financial position. And many times that's in conflict with what's good for an individual person who's trying to get help from them, and that's not really the main goal.
And at the first do no harm policy, that's a conflict of interest. That's a credibility crisis, sir.
Yes, but you know, there's ways that they justify that, because you know, I've heard a lot of doctors say, well, first do no harm, but then what do you do second? Right? And second means get out all the harmful treatments. But you're right, because the thing is that physicians who are trained in this main allopathic system, they have not been taught or exposed to the true healing methods that can really lead people to excellent health. And if they knew about those, they would make a lot of different decisions.
And that alone is a whole nother topic, but it is a credibility crisis on its face as well. Let's talk about unmasking the lies around COVID-19. This is critical because your whole credibility is on the line for this, doctor.
Yes, it certainly is.
And I don't mean that to be thrown down the gauntlet or anything else, but I mean, that's what the community is going to do to you. Sad but true. But you managed to soldier on regardless.
Yeah, well, I knew this in advance, that there was going to be a lot of scrutiny, that any mistakes or skeletons in the closet from my past were going to come out and try to discredit me. And all of that has happened. And, you know, it doesn't bother me that much. I feel like it means that I'm getting important information out there, if it's worthwhile enough for people to spend their time trying to discredit me.
Now, I know Fauci's off his rocker. Even the whole nation is starting to understand and believe that. But Dr. Scott Atlas has been brought onto the Trump administration. Do you think he's the real deal?
Well, it's really difficult to tell. I mean, you know, I haven't seen a lot of action from anyone in the administration that really fits what I see as the reality of the situation. I've heard some positive statements intermittently. But,
and we're grateful for those, but there has to be the real deal behind it, doesn't there?
Absolutely.
And that's why I bring it up, and I'm not really trying to get you to go against or speak for Dr. Scott Atlas, but what I'm getting at is this idea that he's made some great comments, and we're delighted to see hopefully the right direction start to take place there, but we got to see delivery.
Yeah, I totally agree. But, you know, my position is that I don't feel that we should be waiting for any authority figure or any government figure or leader to rescue us from this, that we should find out what's going on ourselves and then take individual action. And once enough of us do that, the leaders will take note and we'll see who is going to come on board and follow what the people want.
You mean the American people should just exercise freedom?
I know it sounds
I love it. All right, so we all come to the Red Pill Expo. There's not a mask in sight, hardly. People are understanding. People are spending time together. People are really getting, in my opinion, energized, strengthened. They don't feel alone. Tell me the psychiatric reality of that.
Well, you know, we've all been repressed for months.
Yes, sir.
You know, we've been now I realize that most of the people here have not been staying in their basement and following the lockdown rules. I certainly have.
That is correct, sir.
But we've been kept away from the other people who are doing that, right?
Yes, right.
And, you know, I feel actually this has been the hardest on my children. Because, you know, since my name is out in the public, all of the people in my area who are like-minded have come out of the woodwork. And now I'm involved in the, you know, with social relationships with these people. But my children, almost none of the parents of any of their friends will allow them to play together in any reasonable way. I mean, they went to the pool at their friend's house and they had to swim on the opposite end of the pool from their friend and like shout across.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding. It's
totally psychotic.
It's extremely disturbing. And so, you know, it's great that there are some other families here because they're having a blast making some friends and getting back to some normal socialization.
All right. Tell me the reality on the ground. The lie mask is one of them. The social distancing mask is another. Social distancing is certainly antisocial. Let's kind of expose some of the lies and then tell what you think we ought to do going forward, doctor.
Sure. Well, so you want me to talk about the lies about the virus specifically?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, we can all see fairly easily the statistics and the number of deaths and how it doesn't add up to the policies. But very, very few people have really looked at the scientific publications around the virus.
Correct.
And that's one of the things that I've really dove into and have spent a lot of time trying to learn the language of virology and figure out what is actually going on with these papers.
And this is why I set the stage as I did. Continue, sir.
So what I found, and I started just looking at this current pandemic situation and the alleged SARS-CoV-2 virus, but this really goes back to the beginning of the modern experiments they do in virology. And what I found out is multiple layers of fraudulent and inconclusive science, bad science. So including violating some basic rules of experimental design, like performing a control study. You know, a control study is absolutely necessary. It's something that I learned about, you know, in high school. And every time I published a paper or wrote a proposal to get approved for human subject research, there had to be a control group in order to get approval.
Yeah, because without it, where's your baseline?
Exactly. It's like you don't know what is influencing what without controlling for the unknown factors. And yet, when they do experiments that allegedly prove the existence of a virus, they don't show this proof by actually showing an intact virus. They show damage to a cell culture of foreign cells, usually monkey cells, and they show that these cells are damaged by an invisible agent that they took out of sick people. But they don't do the same experiment where they take it out of healthy people. To show that it's actually something about the sick, you know, phlegm from the those people that caused the damage to the cells in the culture, because that's actually not what causes it. It's caused by the poisonous substances they mix with the cell culture, which includes antibiotics and things like calf serum.
In other words, you're saying it's the external factors of the experiment that is tainting the reality.
Exactly. They basically loaded the experiment so it would be positive every time, no matter what they put in it. So, in other words,
is that the darned if you do, darned if you don't plan?
If you take sick, like fluid or tissue from any sick person and run it through this experiment, you can show the presence of a virus.
Which means, is there really the presence of the virus?
Well, there's no evidence whatsoever of it. They're talking about such indirect evidence that it's really not meaningful.
In fact, to be honest, it's scientific, almost suicide to go there. Because once you do that, where's the truth? Where's the status line? Where's the baseline, right?
That's right. But the thing is that this experiment was originally done by a doctor named Enders in 1954, and it was published. And even in that publication, as I read yesterday, he basically said this method does not prove that this virus causes this disease.
In other words, he was intellectually honest, at least.
Absolutely. And in that paper, he wrote it in plain language. And after that, he won the Nobel Prize for his work on a measles vaccine. And then he changed his story. And from then on, this experiment was adopted as the sine qua non proof of the existence of a new virus.
Where do we go from here from this knowledge? Certainly these people know this. Even President Trump can understand that, right?
Well, you know, unfortunately, what's happened is that if you look at the way they write these papers, they will make these very strong statements, but the statements don't match what's in the experiment. So, for example, I found several papers that said this virus causes COVID-19, and they referenced other papers as the source of that inflation.
Of that claim, right?
Exactly.
Yep. Okay.
And they use very strong language, like it is caused by, right?
Yes.
So a declarative statement. But then you go back to the reference that they gave to show that, and in that reference it says no such thing whatsoever. So they basically just took something that said, you know, this virus maybe is likely associated with this illness, and then just decided to change that is like, is the definite cause of it. And this is how like a rumor then becomes a fact, and then policy is based upon that. So if you just look at the introduction section or you just read the title of the article, you'll think that it proves a virus.
And then if you dig in too hard like you've done, then they say things like, when did you quit beating your wife?
Well,
right? So there's no good. What I mean is, you can't. How do you answer something like that? It's a lie to start with, right? But there they go.
Well, you know, if someone makes a counter argument against you that is not speaking directly to the topic, then you know that they don't have any way to really argue their point.
Sure. So they'll attack the messenger. They'll do whatever. They'll say, well, there's all kinds of experts that stand against you. They'll use all kind of, I don't know what you call it, but circumstantial realities to try to drive home their point, which has no basis in science or fact.
That's absolutely correct.
All right, those are the lies behind the origins of the virus. Now they're taking this and saying because this virus causes the COVID, and because we need to stop the spread of COVID, now they're going to back into their scientific ideas about distancing and masks and every other lie. They're telling us to, quote, supposedly slow it down. Interestingly, though, they say that when we can slow it down, they never say we can stop it. They never say we won't all get it, right?
Well, you know, they might say that after a vaccine, that may be the case. But, you know, it's really interesting because even if you accept the usual dogma that this is a real virus and it's causing a real illness, still all the studies on social distancing and mask wearing show that it doesn't prevent the disease from being spread. So it's like even, you know, whichever way you look at it, the data is pointing you opposite to what the policies are.
So when they say social distancing, masks, and all these things, they're basing it on the idea that it's airborne. But if we can't prove there's a virus, how can we prove it's airborne?
Well, that's an excellent point. And, you know, there's only one study on what they call asymptomatic transmission, which is really the reason why they're having us do all these things is we're healthy people. We're not symptomatic. We're not sick. And they're worried that we're going to spread it.
Yeah, but right. If you're not sick and you're not symptomatic and you don't develop antibodies to something because your body doesn't recognize they're sick and it doesn't negatively affect your health, the question is, are you sick?
Yeah, exactly. You're not. I mean, you don't need a test to know if you're sick or not. If you don't feel sick, you are not sick.
I'm sick of this circle argument that confuses the public and lies to the rest of us and then attacks those who call a halt to their con game.
Absolutely.
I'm sick, sir. Sick that they're doing this and getting away with it.
Yeah, well, you may be that kind of sick, but you're not the kind of sick where you need any kind of medical tests.
No, I am not, sir. And I don't need a medical test. The other question is, in addition to the science, in addition to the virus, the factual science and the suggestions they're making and the validity thereof, what about the discussion regarding the tests? Because they're just as deceptive. I've got a family member who went and took a test along with 18 other medical professionals, came back, said they all had the virus. Then they started a quarantine, and then they said, well, we better take another test. They took another test. Nobody had it. Where does the truth lie, sir?
Yeah, well, this test is, the one of the biggest parts of this scam because I believe most people, if I, you know, went and surveyed the general public and said, what is this test test for? They would say it tests for a virus. But that's very far from the truth. There actually is no diagnostic test for a virus that's really been developed.
There can't be because it doesn't exist.
Well, they would have to prove that it exists, certainly, before they could test it because, you know, when you have, you're making a new test, you have to compare it to what they call a gold standard. Like, if you wanted to develop a new pregnancy test, you would do the test, and then you'd wait 9 months, and you'd see which woman had a baby come out, right? And that baby coming out, that's the gold standard for pregnancy. You know they have to be pregnant if the baby comes out. So you can then say...
Unless you're just going to lie and say that's not true and attack those who expose it. But yes. Sir.
But you'd witness it yourself if you
Correct.
Wanted to have good science. But,
right. That's
but,
right.
But then, you know, then you can compare how many times when a baby come out was the test positive and get an error rate. And then you know, okay, this test is, you know, such percent accurate and this amount of time it will be inaccurate. For the COVID-19 test and the main test, the one that they say is the most accurate is called the PCR test. And it doesn't test for a virus. It tests for a short, unknown, a short sequence of RNA of unknown origin. So we don't know where that comes from.
In other words, a foreign entity, if you will.
Well, it may be foreign, or it may be from our own genetic material, actually.
Right, but they would claim it would be foreign, right?
Well, they would claim that it's from a virus, but they didn't take it from a virus. They took it from a person's lungs.
Understood.
So that's
why.
My
point is there's a big difference there.
Big
they're
difference.
Playing games with that difference is what I'm driving at.
Absolutely.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
So because there is no gold standard test where they showed a virus and purified one out of a sick person, they couldn't test it against the gold standard. So this test, it's unknown how accurate it is.
So let me drive this home. You're telling me they don't have a gold standard. What they have is a Federal Reserve note standard.
I don't know if it's even as good as that.
Wow. All right, doctor, we appreciate your time. What you're saying and doing is really critical and valuable, especially to the Patriot community, and hopefully as we continue to spread the word to others who will understand the lies, who will hold them to account for their dishonesty and their manipulation of society. And as a psychiatrist, before I let you go, is this just going to mess up generations, sir?
I'm very, very concerned about that, especially what they're doing with the children in the schools. And in fact, I was even retained to testify about the psychological damages from mask wearing on children. And it's pretty incredible. Because it's not just that it will cause distress, cause them to be afraid of other people, could traumatize them because of it represents a life-threatening situation, but also it impairs their development cognitively and socially.
Yeah, in other words, they can't learn the cues that you normally get from interaction.
That's right, and they're going to not be able to recognize people's faces. They're not going to be able to read emotional expression, and they're going to have problem just understanding plain old language.
Oh, boy, sir, we got our hands full. Now, you're doing other things, too. You're working with people and developing some new products. Just to kind of give a promo for that and your website, and we'll let you fly.
Yeah, sure. Well, my website is andrewkaufmanmd.com, and I do some natural healing consultations. But I also have recently come out with a product called Shilajit Mumio.
Shilajit Mumio.
Yes, I know. Those are some foreign names, but it essentially is a trace mineral product that comes out of cracks in the mountains, and it's been used in healing for millennia from the Ayurvedic tradition in India as well as in Russia. And I found a domestic source of this material that's extremely clean with no detectable mercury. And this is basically to replenish the minerals, and there's about 75 or 80 of them, that are missing from our diets these days because of modern agricultural practices. So this is something I generally recommend that everyone take just to replenish it. But it can help with certain conditions like sexual dysfunction, especially in men, and peripheral neuropathy where you get, you know, pins and needles in your fingers and toes, that kind of condition. And it can help with heavy metal detoxification. So it's a very useful type of nutritional product, and I'm glad to be offering it for sale at this time.
AndrewKaufmanMD.com is where you go, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll keep up to speed on your work on a variety of fronts, sir, and I hope we can get you a Donald Trump so somebody can level with the public for once.
I'd be happy to take a meeting.
What do you think our chances are?
pretty small.
Pretty? All right, our pleasure with you, brother.
Thank you very much. Great
Liberty
to be here.
Roundtable Live.